are being redirected. We are living in an artificially induced state of consciousness that resembles sleep.
Dissonance.
Wait for it.
Oh, this is eerie. That's exactly what I was thinking not 10 seconds ago during the slight crescendo that opens our opening.
Somebody, grab that little squeaky voice guy and throttle him. Put him to the mat.
Hello and good evening. It's 7:02 Thursday, September 13th.
Lucky 13, following a 6th anniversary of that date that is now
that
a number. September.
Dreadful day. Yes.
So, here we are again. Thank you for joining us, and I better stop that before something terrible happens. This is Precognitive Dissonance with Craig York.
And Miles Lewis.
Hey. Again, thanks for joining us, and goodness gracious. What do we got to talk about today, man? I printed out a bunch of stuff. I posted a bunch of links.
I read a bunch of stuff, and something I read yesterday. I've mentioned the Strange Ark cryptozoology site and the Strange Ark blog a couple of times. Unfortunately, I tend to find it a little difficult to access a lot of the time. That's unfortunately mainly at work. Your tax dollars at work, friends. But yesterday popped in without a hitch and noticed this entry for, unfortunately, considerably earlier in the month, but you have until the 17th. It's the Online Cryptozoology Book Review Contest. And I'm going to read verbatim from the blog, even though I'm tremendously distracted by the alien sex image that Miles just put up on the screen.
That wasn't on purpose, really.
You can submit up to three book reviews for this contest. Once you have written a review, it must be posted online to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com and available to read there by the 17th of September, 2007. Once it is up on the site, you must send an email to chadarment@verizon.net. That's chadarment at Verizon.net to let me know that you are submitting that online review to the contest. Basic rules. Any nonfiction cryptozoology book from any publisher, including a reprinted classic, is eligible for review so long as it A, the current ISBN was first published between 2000 and the present, B, it is still in print and available from distributors, not just the used book dealers, and C, is at least 75% focused on mystery animals, not just a general 14 anthology, etc. 2. The review needs to be honest, objective, and intelligently written. The rating you give the book will not be taken into consideration. 3. The review must be posted under your real name, not an anonymous name. 4. The review must be new, posted between now and the contest's end. The review should focus on the book, its merits, its scope, and or its implications for cryptozoology. It should not be a generic discourse on cryptozoology, the author, or other irrelevant points. 6. Obviously, authors shouldn't review their own books, but are more than welcome to review others. The individual with the most interesting review, as judged by myself and a small cadre, will receive their choice of Does Champ Exist?, Odomen's the Great Sea Serpent, or Cryptozoology and the Investigation of Lesser-Known Mystery Animals. Mr. Armand adds in an aside at the end, a parenthetical aside, yes, interesting is subjective. I'll be looking at conciseness, depth, detail, and discernment, as well as personality, clarity, and insight. Simple enough, right? And I urge you, if you're at all interested in this, to go to Mr. Armand's blog, strangeark.com is the homepage, and the blog link is right there in front of you. Most recent entry was on a a known animal, but one that is on the border of the cryptozoological. It's the Chinese mountain cat. And the initial image that you see, it looks for all the world like your standard moggy just out in the grass. It's only some of the later photographs that you realize, that's a little bit different. I think you'll have to scroll down a little bit for it.
Well, that's really cool. That sounds like a great contest.
Indeed, and that's at strangeart.com/blog/.
Awesome.
There's also an update on, remember I was talking about the giant spider web.
Dude, and I've heard so many people, I've overheard so many conversations, people like, oh, did you hear about that freaking huge spider web? And then, telltale sound of people that are highly freaked out by spiders.
It gets more interesting because although initial images, the news video from the site, only showed you basically a spider crawling around somebody's hand in a couple of scenes, and I was able to kind of tentatively identify it as what I thought was called fishing spider. Another fellow I'm acquainted with said they're a type of orb weaver or grass spider. But
are those the kind that take flight with the
The young trail out the strand of silk and
catch wind and
Didn't
I say that? I thought when we brought this up, that was one of the first things that came to mind was, wow, I can imagine like this huge or bunch of them or a huge mass of them, kind of like ants clumped together in disasters of water disasters stuff to like survive.
Or wrap themselves around a fragment of ice and iron to warm it to drinkable temperature. Reality and fantasy, there is no line between them, friends.
Yeah.
Anyway, the interesting thing about this is that it's not one single species of spider. It's scores of different. Arachnid expert Hank Guarisco of Fort Hays State University in Hays, Kansas, traveled to Texas to take a look for himself. He camped at the park observing the spiders at night because some of them are nocturnal. He said he was impressed with the variety of spiders contributing to the web. Quote, Tetranagthidae are usually solitary spiders who build their own webs and mind their own business, he said. Here they are sharing a lot of foundation strands that are all over the place. They don't have individual webs anymore. So, you know, this is not only
like new type of behavior. Ooh.
Well, you see there at the top of the second paragraph.
Normally, they are cannibalistic and their webs are separated, said Alan Dean, a Texas A&M University entomologist.
They live in harmony because there's so much food available.
Woohoo!
So
they feed on human prey.
Well,
I'm trying to do my best movie trailer.
They'd have
in a world.
The thing is, it sort of blows away one of my minor objections to the thoroughly enjoyable but scientifically ludicrous film, Eight-Legged Freaks. Because the premise is basically toxins in the water get into the food supply of, it's actually a guy that owns a pet store that specializes in exotic spiders. He feeds them crickets that have drunk this toxin-laced water, and they begin to grow to prodigious size. Mm. And I found myself watching this film and going, you know, that many different species of spiders would not cooperate.
Unless they had plenty of prey.
And that they certainly do. So it's kind of like, it's a little scary when something you regard as patently ludicrous turns out to be not so silly.
Gets a little support from the science arena.
Yeah. Mm. Well, you know, there's still the inverse square law, which, you know, pretty much prevents anything with an exoskeleton getting much above, a foot and a half, 2 feet in length. out of the water, that is. Yeah. The Japanese spider crab still reaches a width of 13, 14 feet. But hey, you know, how many of us are going to go swimming in the waters off northern Japan? Not me.
Well, there's so much other interesting and weird news out there. One of the more interesting things I just looked into the last 24 hours is this scientist who's done the burning of seawater using radio waves.
Yeah, that's one of those. I probably should look at the background articles. But the first thing that I thought of is something that another friend of mine who's a little bit more scientifically trained also pointed out in another forum, is that the radio frequency energy, which is what the guy is using, also it may be an instance where it's an interesting bit of fireworks, but the net, there'd be no net gain in energy. You expend more energy generating the radio waves to burn the seawater than you would in getting energy out of the seawater from the liberation of energy.
Hmm.
Yeah. But it's still pretty cool.
Well,
I mean, what
the,
a death ray.
I mean, the videos make it look like it's fairly... I mean, they attach a motor and the motor's chugging away. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know how much energy... I don't know the nature of the radio frequency energy he's having to put out to do this.
Or the level of it.
I do have a clip we can listen to here. It's... Actually, there's several clips, but we'll only listen to, like, the first one or so. Hopefully.
Instead of paying almost $4 for gas, how would you like to run your car on salt water? Now, it may sound crazy, but wait until you see what a local inventor has come up with that could change the world. And as Channel 3's Michael Mara shows us, that's not all he's trying to do.
Retired TV station owner and broadcast engineer John Kansas was not looking for an answer to the energy crisis. He was looking for a way to cure cancer. 4 years ago, inspiration struck in the middle of the night. Why not use radio waves to kill the cancer cells?
Well, the best thing that would work as antennas was I could find them at 3 o'clock in the morning, was my wife's pie pants.
His wife, Marianne, heard the noise and found her husband inventing a radio frequency generator using her pie pans.
I got up immediately and thought he'd lost it.
Here are the basics of John's idea. Radio waves will heat certain metals, like gold. Tiny bits of that metal are injected into a cancer patient. Those nanoparticles are attracted to the abnormalities of the cancer cell and ignore the healthy cells. The patient is then exposed to radio waves, and only the bad cells heat up and die. Killing cancer cells is amazing, but John had also stumbled on yet another amazing breakthrough.
You have nothing in it?
His machine could actually burn salt water. John Kansas discovered that his radio frequency generator could release the oxygen and hydrogen from salt water and create an incredibly intense flame.
Just like that. If that was inside a car cylinder, you could see the amount of fire that would be in the cylinder. I can put my hand in here.
Put your hand into the beam, nothing happens. Put in a fluorescent bulb and it lights up immediately. At the APV Company Laboratory in Akron, top engineers have checked out John's amazing invention and they were amazed.
And we saw it go up to 1,500 degrees centigrade, the temperature. And it's incredible.
This simple Stirling engine is running with the heat generated by the flames coming off that test tube. The fuel, nothing more than salt water.
Well, that could be a steam engine, a steam turbine. Could be a car engine if you wanted it to be.
That's the true American innovator. Someone that is not looking for something, he just finds it.
This is the most abundant element in the world, water. And salt water is everywhere. And to see it burn actually gives me chills.
So imagine the possibilities. Salt water as the ultimate clean fuel, a happy byproduct of one man searching for a cure for cancer. In Erie, Pennsylvania, Michael Mara, Channel 3 News.
That is amazing. We want it now. Inventor John Kansas says that if some big company wants to buy up his saltwater fuel invention, that's okay. He wants to use all the money to finish his quest to find a cure for cancer.
So,
okay, yeah. There's actually fascinating.
There's several other clips. I got that off of YouTube, of course, and they've somebody's compiled a bunch of the clips, probably him. Not just the Akron, Ohio, was that the scientists who tested it? You know, I would think that it would occur to them how wow the factor is on this by weighing, like you're saying, how much energy and resources do we have to pump in to get this high temperature or whatever. But I mean, okay, so if it's not real, whatever. I mean, the idea here is pretty amazing. I mean, just the it seems like a pretty powerful meme that could get people's hopes up. You know,
well,
they think,
you know,
I mean that they think the most of the planet's covered by salt water. So, waha.
It's definitely a story I'm gonna want to keep track of. The thing about it is, you know, I know enough science to know that the second stage, the burning water, that's like got to be impossibly clean because I believe it's the oxygen that's burning. I think it says at the top of the article that
this particular article is at cbsnews.com. Possible energy source, burning seawater. Cancer researcher discovers hydrogen from saltwater can be burned by radio frequencies. Erie, Pennsylvania, September 10th.
Oh, there it is.
And
yes.
This guy's name is John Kansas, and Kansas is spelled K-A-N-Z-I-U-S. And, of course, there's a link off of precognitive dissonance.
Here's the paragraph I was looking for. The radio frequencies act to weaken the bonds between the elements that make up saltwater, releasing the hydrogen. Roy said, once ignited, the hydrogen will burn as long as it is exposed to the frequencies. And, you know, hydrogen is the lightest flammable element there is. It leaves virtually no residue when it burns. So,
in the video, there's no smoke or anything. It's just a completely red flame, which isn't the hottest, but this is just from tap water and salt in a small test tube. I mean, imagine if you know somebody was tinkering with this, you can always figure out the way to pull the most energy out of the process.
But Miles, it seems like there would be at least one byproduct, and that's the oxygen. As we know, oxygen. It was when the Earth's atmosphere was oxygen rich that we got dragonflies with 3-foot wingspans.
Cool.
And,
so we got
10-foot long carnivorous millipedes.
Oh man, dude!
Giant bugs. You know.
We were just talking.
I'm
about
ready for them.
All right. See, it's more. It's all coming in together.
Well, you know, I'm probably going to be able to tie everything we talk about tonight to giant bugs because it's one of my favorite things. But anyway, what else we got?
Oh, goodness. Oh, we got a few throwaway articles. I think it was...
Something from the Canadian.
Yeah, the Canadian National Newspaper. That was the one that last week we mentioned, the article that we'd mentioned the previous week, which had shown up on Rents.com by a apparent former astronaut who brushed elbows with
Wernher von Braun at Roswell. Subsequently, but the upshot of it was that von Braun had been at Roswell and seen extraterrestrial bodies or, you know,
and a crash object.
Hydrocephalic bodies. Yeah. Progerian. There we go.
Progeriatric bodies. Interestingly enough, the newspaper that came from, which is called the Canadian National Newspaper, which is at agoracosmopolitan.com, they have a real brief, like, public announcements. Pro-Democracy Media Foundation explores extraterrestrial contact with earthbound humanity by John Stokes. Are humans still seeking to make contact with intelligent life in the universe, or is humanity being manipulated into this perception of non-contact in order to cover up the use of manipulative extraterrestrial technologies to enslave humankind? Rolls eyes. Are you interested in exploring research and insights concerning extraterrestrials and UFOs? Would you like to see additional articles and critical commentaries in the Canadian National Newspaper about extraterrestrials and UFOs? Then show your support. Make a member pledge donation in support of the membership drive of the Pro-Democracy Media Foundation. It goes on. So apparently this newspaper is a not-for-profit national newspaper with an international readership. And, of course, they've got their sexy news talking head in the
become a member. She
member
reminds me of somebody.
It's kind of interesting. I don't know.
Well, it sounds like it dovetails with the whole carrot vibe that's out there.
The CARET carrot.
Yes.
Not carrot.
Actually, kind of like the weight of diamonds.
It feeds right into the exopolitical.
And we should get political with them. Are cooperating with them.
Yeah, because it was at the Bilderberg meeting, what's the Davos? It was at the Davos meeting that the Financial Times reported a couple of years ago that there was a lecture about the impact of open alien contact. I'll have to dig that up in a second, but who knows?
Yeah.
Regular listeners know that I have my own thoughts about how such belief and expectation could be manipulated by various powers that be, but that's a whole can of worms. Another article that caught my attention is one that's coming out of this AmericanChronicle.com, which I think is connected to a series of other alternative news sites, including Starstream Research, who just launched a new website called starpod.org. And these guys, the Starstream Research guys, I've noticed several articles over the last year from them investigating the Stargate remote viewing program and recently continuing to be declassified documents. Apparently something like 70,000 documents have been declassified just in the last couple of years, and 50,000 remain. And this is the stuff that Hal Puthoff, Paul Smith, and other military viewers have been tight-lipped about for the last 10, 20, however long many years it's been. First, since the program was made public and dissolved by, I think, some of the criticisms of Jessica Utz, wasn't it? We'll talk about her a little later. I could be mistaken. But anyway, American Chronicle has an article now called Warning Notice, Anomalous Mental Phenomena, AMP, and the War on Terror, dated September 10th, 2007, by Gary S. Beckham. And I was, of course, looking to see some more new information, but it's basically a rehashing of what they've been saying all along, which is that there's this obvious tool here that could be being used in the war on terror, whatever you believe about that, the war on terror, let alone what you believe about psychic remote viewing. But it's one of those,
Miles, it's one of the basic fundamental freedoms that FDR believed in.
What?
Fear, terror.
Oh. So this article rehashes something that they made me aware of, which actually is rather interesting, and I want to ask Paul Smith about, and that is that there was, the authorities have said, that post 9/11, the authorities were saying, we never had any intel about planes being flown into buildings, and in fact, a good example can be found in the 9/11 events of 2001. Reviews of the intelligence community concluded there was, quote, no examination of the potential for terrorists to use aircraft as weapons as distinguished from traditional hijackings, unquote. However, this is not entirely true. AMP-based sources repeatedly warned of aircraft used as weapons as early as December of 1983. One DIA AMP source warned of air attacks against buildings involving the collapse of a building and great destruction in New York City and Washington, D.C. Plots were described involving failed attacks against the White House and the U.S. Capitol building, as occurred when 9/11 Flight 93 failed to reach the intended target. All of these items can be found in the 89,000 pages of Stargate files already released by the CIA. Another 50,000 pages remain unreleased. And there was drawings from this session and so forth. It may have been on this show, or maybe it was on PSYOP Radio, that I mentioned this other article and how the previous article where they found these references and these declassified Stargate documents that seemed to show that there was a session done by these remote viewers that intimated 9/11, though they were trying to reach into the immediate future for a particular July 4th celebration. And they took this recently declassified data and their analysis to Paul Smith, military remote viewer, and asked him, hey, you participated in this. Remember this? Doesn't this remind you of 9/11? And his response was basically, you know, you're right. I think your analysis on this is accurate to suggest that, well, it's highly suggestive of those events. And anyway, that's kind of interesting. And this is, again, from starpod.org, americanchronicle.com, Starstream Research. They've been doing a lot of reporting on these continuing to be declassified Stargate remote viewing documents.
It's one of those. It's a little frustrating because they don't cite any specific documents. It's when I read something like all of these items can be found in the 89,000 pages of Stargate files already released by the CIA.
Well, I think they may link to their other articles where they have those citations because they do have excerpts of the documents on the website.
Okay.
But, yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying. This article is kind of like don't forget, we're still investigating this, and it's the anniversary. It's a perfect time to remind you about it.
Well, and it's one of those instances where, kind of frustrating, it's how do you effectively utilize prophecy that's, sufficiently detailed to give you a sense of the shape of the, well, in this instance, threat, but not the precise timing or,
Well, and that's just it. They were trying to see into the future, but only short time. And given that there might be something that actually dwarfs what they were imagining in the near term, or the far term, and I mean near term compared to what they, compared to long-range history, it seems like, it's just something that it's a good example of how intelligence doesn't get passed around often, perhaps. And I just find it interesting that there's a possible connection to somebody trying to precognitively grok terrorism, actually getting a hit with 9/11, since I've reported on so many instances where that's happened by chance or accident, where people have spontaneous psychic experiences. So from the Wikipedia, which we all know now is basically PR disinfo fodder now. For those of you who haven't heard, there's a program that was written by a nice little hacktivist, and the program's called Wikiscanner. If you Google that, use Google. Use Scroogle, Scroogle, and look up Wikiscanner, and you'll find out all about how everybody from the Vatican to the GOP to PR firms and various political and corporate entities are being caught rewriting and the Wikipedia information, and often, of course, making bad things better, erasing history. Talk about revisionist activities. But the reason I bring up the Jessica Utz is there's a new article from the 10th of this month. UC Davis statistician analyzes validity of paranormal predictions. This is out of the California Aggie. That's CaliforniaAggie.com. And, yeah, indeed it was her. I thought it was her. She and Dr. Ray Hyman were the ones tasked with evaluating the CIA-DIA remote viewing program. And, I mean, I don't want to – it's been a while since I read her analysis, but it was because of their analysis that it was basically deemed a failure. And largely this, you know, the whole outing of the program, the whole dissolving of it was a PR campaign. It was basically the shedding of controversial baggage by those Alphabet agencies who, even though they, some of them had liked the program over the time, some mm-hmm. of them had loved the program, some of them had hated the program, they'd all gotten some usefulness out of it over the years. But
there's a couple of telling lines in here. Jessica Utz was one of two statisticians who were approached to conduct this study. The other was Dr. Ray Hyams. And
Hyman.
The two
Hyman.
Oh. The two reports opposed each other, with the Utz report saying that the evidence was strong and that future research should focus on how to apply remote viewing. Gifted subjects score 2% above chance. Is that, yeah, okay, that's how it reads. Thank you.
While the Hyman report stated that while there were definite results achieved, it was unclear what the mechanism was. Funding for the project was stopped after this report was issued.
Yeah.
So, classic me. I'm totally tarring her when she was the one actually giving the positive report. Sorry,
and
Jessica.
The telling phrase in there to me is it was unclear what the mechanism was. If you can't, and that's, you know...
But
that
if you find operational
the chief flaw in the mindset of especially military intelligence, if you can't turn it on and off with a switch, and I confess, I fall prey to that mindset myself at times. But
some of the most powerful things in the universe are those that are the hardest to observe or figure out. Ken Wilber in Ecology, Sex, and Spirituality. I forget. It's those three words.
You don't believe in politics. What do you believe in? Sex and death. Two things that happen once in a lifetime. At least after death, you don't get nauseous.
That we know
Woody
of.
Woody Allen in Sleeper.
Ah. Very funny sci-fi comedy
movie. Pass me the orb, will you?
No. Alrighty. So, UC Davis statistician analyzes validity of paranormal predictions by Jennifer Wolfe. This is, again, from September 10th. Jessica Utz, professor of statistics at UC Davis, has been one of the few statisticians to work in the field of parapsychology, analyzing data and helping with experimental design. Quote, as a statistician, we can work on data in any field, and it's still the same statistical method, she said. Utz earned a bachelor's degree in math and psychology at the State University of New York at Binghamton in 1973 and a doctorate in statistics from Penn State University in 1978. Later, she's quoted as saying, the two of us did this review and we both, oh, talking about the Hyman research, the two of us did this review, sorry, the two of us did this review and we both concluded that there were really strong statistical results there, but Hyman still didn't believe that it could be explained by something psychic. He thought there would be some explanation that he can't provide. According to Utz, meta-analysis of the 966 studies performed at Stanford Research Institute, subjects could identify the target correct 34% of the time. The probability of these results occurring by chance is point a lot of zeros, 4-3. All right. So, but again, she found a statistically significant amount.
And it's kind of interesting because I think I mentioned a few weeks ago that I was renewing my acquaintance with a book I'd read when I was back in Minneapolis almost 30 years ago called The Paranormal by Stan Gooch. And one of the strongest memories I took away from it was in later chapters, Gooch kind of asserts that the paranormal may not be susceptible to the scientific method. And about halfway through the book, there's basically a couple of chapters in which he, a rather complex series of arguments, which I'm not going to try and encapsulate, pretty much tosses out the notion that the statistical method and conventional science can do much in the way of documenting or explaining the paranormal.
Well, that's one tool.
Yeah. So. But I still think it's a fascinating book. And I think this is pretty interesting, too. I mean, I think you know that on more than one occasion in the past, I've been kind of wishy-washy on the subject of remote viewing and psychic phenomena generally, simply because tends not to be repeatable, you know. But
see, that's just it. They repeated it for 20 yeah. years and were able to use it operationally. And I mean, maybe not, again, to the on-offness that the military wanted, but... and again, like, think about that Sony article that we talked about on the previous episode that Patrick Hui wrote about, where Sony proved to their satisfaction that, yep, this stuff's real, precognition... ESP, parapsychological, anomalous cognition, is real, but, oh, we can't figure out a way to marketing it or utilizing it or, yeah. So, I don't know. I guess it really does come down to it. There's still just so much freaking stigma attached to all this. There's a couple of things over there on the shelf that,
one great big honking.
That's part one.
Oh, dear God.
Perspectives.
Perspectives in Psychical Research, which is a very weighty tome of some 700 pages.
And that's just volume one.
And that is just volume one.
And it's heavily cited and footnoted and notated. Hey, kitty cat, stop that.
Sorry, dead air. I was just getting engrossed in a... an account in here about a woman named Mary Reynolds. This looks like a kind of trance state account. Actually, it sounds like a classical split personality. Miles also has The Journal of Religion and Psychical Research. This is issue from October 1992. Fairly plain pamphlet-style publication. Why Kundalini is Not Enough. Astrology in the Aquarian Age by John R. Crowley. Series of short articles, book reviews.
The Revelations of Urantia.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. How many cassettes is that?
Oh, gosh. Miles is alluding to the largest single book we ever duplicated at the Talking Book program. I want to say it was something like... over 20 cassettes.
With each cassette having 4 hour-and-a-half long sides.
Yeah.
That Urantia book set is huge.
Of course, as far as I know, we've never duplicated any Madame Blavatsky. Blavatsky? Blavatsky?
Blavatsky, Blavatsky.
Blavatsky.
You say Blavatsky, I say what?
I say it succotash, and I say the hell with it.
Shenanigans! I call shenanigans!
Oh,
so, Yeah, those are part of a donation that's recently been made to the Anomaly Archives Lending Library of the Scientific Anomaly Institute. Has yet to be cataloged, but it's part of about a three bag donation that's actually the second series of donations from this particular donor, who's a local past life regression therapist, and she donated a huge set of those Journal of Religion and Psychical Research newsletters, journals, and a bunch of books, and awesome stuff. We're really cool, wide range of...
A wonderful asset to the archives.
Yeah, and to, of course, to our research. Yeah. Among the other articles of late, there's something, the Robertson panel, the CIA considers UFOs. This is from... Well, this is a weird website. I don't know the name of it, but it's PR-GB. I'm guessing it's a press release news article website. And this is by, well, it says Editor's Choice, written by Editor's Choice. That's interesting. 1918 to 1939 is sometimes called the Golden Age of Aviation because of the much technological advancement made in aircraft. With World War II came better, faster airplanes and more experienced pilots. By the time the war was over, air travel was becoming firmly established across the world. The skies became the highways of the future. People started looking up in curiosity. What they saw in the skies was sometimes mundane, but sometimes astonishing. The UFO age had begun. So this is leading into the 50s. And talking about the CIA's Robertson panel that convened. And the CIA responded by forming a committee to investigate the thousands of UFO reports and choose a course of action. Committee headed by Howard Percy Robertson came to be known as the Robertson panel. Now, the thing that isn't always intrigued me about the Robertson panel was is Valet's contention that they were duped, that they weren't made aware. They were supposed to be, you know, scientists are given all the available data and make a conscious, informed decision. And actually, this does relate to our day job. This is the one where Battelle, UFOs, and digital talking books. In my day job, I produce audiobooks for the blind and print disabled, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, somebody got the contract to investigate the new digital player, and it was the Battelle Institute. And Battelle has its connections to UFO history around the time of the Robertson panel. What I wrote for the Anomaly Archives newsletter back in April 2005, when I learned about Battelle's involvement with digital talking books, was one of the probable reasons for UFO researcher Jacques Vallée's suspicions about the potential use of UFOs as a form of disinfo and double cross was his 1967 discovery of what has become known as the Pentacle Memo. The document led Vallée to the discovery of secret dealings between Battelle Memorial Institute and the United States Military Intelligence Complex and plans to simulate large waves of UFOs. All of this information was kept secret from the famous scientific Robertson panel that was tasked by the United States government to assess UFOs. And it's kind of, the story about this is really interesting. This was all revealed in his book, Forbidden Science, which I know you've expressed interest in reading. It's his journals. And also interesting, coinky dink, the individual, I believe, that he termed Pentacle, his first or last name was Miles. But basically, from the Pentacle Memo, an article over at CUFON.org, CUFON.org, the Pentacle proposal goes far beyond anything mentioned before. It daringly states that, quote, many different types of aerial activity should be secretly and purposefully scheduled within the area, unquote. It is difficult to be more clear. We are not talking simply about setting up observing stations and cameras. We are talking about large-scale covert simulation of UFO waves under military control.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes on, the greatest implication, which is perhaps not obvious on first reading, but which amounts to a scandal of major proportion in the eyes of any scientist, has to do with the outright manipulation of the Robertson panel. Here is a special meeting of the five most eminent scientists in the land assembled by the government to discuss a matter of national security. Not only are they not made aware of all the data, but another group has already decided what can and cannot be discussed. Pentacle's own words. When the meeting when they meet. Dr. Hynek categorically stated to me that the panel was not briefed about the Pinnacle proposals. Other researchers in the UFO field, I think like Jerry Clark and others, have basically said that Vallée is, as usual, overreacting and saying that he's speculating too broadly and that this doesn't mean that much of anything other than, yeah, you know, this stuff should have been given over to the Robertson panel so that they could have made a more informed decision. So from this article, this more recent article that's dated September 12th, the panel met in secret for four consecutive days. During this time, they viewed two amateur motion pictures, the 1950 Montana and the 1952 Utah UFO films, which had already undergone 1,000 man-hours of detailed analysis by Navy officers who had concluded that the depicted objects were not any known aircraft, creature, or weather phenomena. Air Force Captain Edward J. Ruppelt and Major Dewey J. Fournay then addressed the panel, summarizing the extensive work they had been involved with in UFO affairs over the preceding years. Ultimately, the panel spent 12 hours considering reports and investigations that Project Blue Book and other committees had spent years investigating. They speedily found explanations for the reports. When there was no answer to be found, they swept the case under the table.
Man, this is like the 15th season of The X-Files. Yeah, it just seems, well, you know, every time it seems like there's starting to be some, not progress, but it's almost like UFOs do not permit themselves to be studied. Yeah. And that's it's a, something that I've come up with in ufology, or come up against in ufology and cryptozoology, is that, you know, in the absence of an actual landing or the corpse of Nessie being dragged down to the British Museum for dissection.
We've got the big squids for that.
Yeah. You know, people keep seeing things. People keep reporting things. But, by golly, there's nothing we can reach out and pluck a tuft of fur off of, or, you know, tickle under the chin.
Except spiders and tickle, tickle, tickle.
Chinese mountain cats. I did want to mention something that it gives me hope. The Center for Fortean Zoology, based out of England, but now with a U.S. component, and I believe an Australian component, too, is sponsoring an expedition to Guyana in search of giant snakes.
Yeah, actually, I posted a video of that call to on Wednesday. It was yesterday, yeah. Or, no? There's a video of it on Anomaly TV. It's man, they've got pictures of them, some locals, carrying a huge anaconda across a road. Freaking gigantic. Well, of course, Nick Redfern is their stateside rep, and his website's monsterusa.blogspot.com. And their website, cfz.org.uk. And that page always, dang JavaScript. But that's, cfz.org.uk.
And there's the blog post, more on the CFZs. This is one of those. I respect Nick an awful lot for posting it. Guyana, the publicity marches on. It's a video game or computer gaming site that talks about more the funding and publicity aspects, and it opens with Capcom have lost it. Shouldn't that be Capcom has lost it? At least their marketing department has. They've announced that they're going to be funding an expedition deep into some South American jungle manned by the nutty Center for Fortean Zoology with the aim of recovering specimens and or proof of giant anacondas, which are rumored to clock in at 40 feet long. So, yes, a monster hunt. in honor of Monster Hunter Freedom 2. Best of luck, gents, and I hope Capcom's funding extends to coverage should your entire team be eaten alive by a 40-foot jungle snake. Press release follows.
Oh, cool. That's I'll have to post a link to that. That's pretty freaking funny. I remember after last week's episode, I ended up showing you some clips from
Starship Invasion.
No, it was Invasion UFO.
That's right. Invasion.
What you're looking at is the poster for Starship Invasions, which is what I wanted to talk about. That was another video that my friend gave me, and
great poster.
I've been wondering about this for a long time.
Bears. Let me guess. Bears absolutely no resemblance to anything in the film.
Oh no! Actually, that's everything you see there is
even
from
the UFO.
Film.
Oh, that's cool.
Which one? There's that one. There's those. Yeah, I think if you go to imdb.com, you can Google or search for Starship Invasions.
So fairly fun cheese, or
This is Starship Invasions is great, and it was written and directed by Ed Hunt, starring Robert Vaughn, Christopher Lee.
Oh, wow.
Now, this movie, it scared the bejesus out of me. This movie, I must have seen it in a TV guide log that, Starship Invasions, UFOs, attack Earth or something, because I was at a friend's house spending the night and was like, hey, man, I want to watch this. It's about UFOs. And he was like, oh, okay. He wasn't really into it. And it just freaked me out. It's like
Helen Shaver?
The very basic, one of the basic ideas is that there's multiple alien races in a kind of an underwater UN here on Earth, and there's this race of telepathic humanoids. All the aliens are telepathic. None of them actually ever speak, including Christopher Lee, who plays the head of the bad guy aliens, who are, of course, in black tights with crazy headdresses. With big winged serpents on their chests. And basically their planet is dying, so they decide to take over the Earth, and they're going to do it by basically orbiting a mind-control satellite that causes people to go on mass killing sprees and commit suicide. And the scenes of people committing violence and suiciding themselves just really, really freaked me out.
It's a disturbing premise. I mean, it's one of those movies that sounds like nine kinds of cheese, but
But what I didn't remember, and I guess I didn't know at the time because I wasn't as versed in UFO lore and literature as I am now, but it's really got a lot of elements that were specifically put in there that are from real cases. I mean, the opening scene is practically an American retelling of the Antonio Villaboas incident. The winged serpents on the
Softcore?
Almost. And the winged serpents on the villain's alien suits is from a particular UFO case.
That's one of the early contactee logo kind of things.
And the case I'm thinking of is actually not, but I think you're right that kind of symbol has appeared in contactee cases as well. They're little robots, are these short guys, and that's where their form departs from the Pascagoula claw men. They're robots, are these little short claw-handed, silver-suited, robotic-moving guys with the real pointing nose and ears coming off the sides.
But that does kind of tie in directly with the whole kind of mechanical dwarf aspect of a lot of Close Encounters from the 50s and 60s.
So it was a lot of fun. It's great in some ways, awful in others, but as I said, it really freaked me out as a kid, the whole violence angle. And that, too, is actually kind of interesting because here this movie was made in 77, and Kiel and Vallée, were intimating that governments were worried about UFO phenomena because of some psycho killer kind of aspects, but that's too much to get into here in the last 5 minutes. But
let's definitely take it up again next week.
Certainly.
So I should mention in the last few minutes here, of course, AnomalyRadio.com, where you're listening to us through, is about to unveil its new fall, schedule lineup, and we've added a whole bunch of shows, and this is all launching next week. Some of the new shows, we've got all the same old shows that we have had for the last year and a half, Greg Bishop's show, Robert Larson, Scott Horton, Angela Keaton, all of course, our show, Precognitive Dissonance, is staying in the same time slot. But we're adding a whole bunch of great other shows, including Tim Banal's Banal of America. We're going to be rebroadcasting his podcast and hopefully maybe moving forward with his live shows once he goes into a new season. Actually, he doesn't do live shows yet. Black Vault Radio, some of you might remember John Greenwald Jr. He was the youngest ufologist several years ago when he was like 16 years old and started using the Freedom of Information Act, and now has thousands and thousands, I mean tens of thousands of documents from the United States government detailing everything from MK Ultra to advanced aviation fusion reactors and technology to, of course, lots of UFO stuff. And we're also adding, and his show is called Black Vault Radio. We're also adding...
Dick Cheney!
No, that's not Dick Cheney. Red Ice Creations Radio. This is a real interesting country web radio show dealing with very interesting metaphysical, parapolitical stuff coming out of, I forget if it's not, is it the Netherlands they're from? I forget, but it's that arena. And
when's that airing?
I can't tell you just yet. That hasn't been revealed.
Ah.
But... we're going to be rebroadcasting their shows. Also, one of the longest-running UFO lists on the Internet, UFO Updates, the list manager, Errol Bruce Knapp, is also a long-term radio show host, and his show, his podcast, Strange Days Indeed, is going to be re-airing on the Anomaly Radio Network, so we're real excited about that. And you've probably already been hearing our live relay of Dr. Catherine Albrecht's show Uncovering the Truth, which I call Spy Chips Uncovering the Truth, because she's covering all the RFID radio frequency identifier surveillance technology issues. And of course, we're also adding Visigoth's Grassy Knoll. And actually, I'm going to be on Visigoth's show sometime in the next week or two. Coming up this Friday is a special Blue Rose Report on a Friday. Normally it's Wednesday nights, but this Friday I'm interviewing Ken Thomas, parapolitical researcher and publisher who does Steam Shovel Press at steamshovelpress.com, and we'll be talking about the connections.
The folks that put out The Octopus, which we talked about on the show.
Right. He was the author of The Octopus after Danny Casolaro was suicided and couldn't write the book.
What were some of the other titles there?
The Maury Island UFO, Inside the Gemstone File, and his more recent one, Parapolitics, which I've been reading, and... But try to tune into that next week. No, wait. No, that's tomorrow. Yeah, tomorrow here on Anomaly Radio from 7 to 8 p.m. So,
there or BL7.
Well, thanks for tuning in. We'll be here next week. And that may be our week for, Nick Redfern. We'll be probably talking about his new book, Memoirs of a Monster Hunter.
Hopefully he'll have a little update on the Guyana expedition and other recent events, probably an update or two from the Canuck Chase. And this is Craig York.
And I'm Smiles Lewis, signing off. Thanks for listening.
See you again next week.